From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caritti, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. And on this day, opponents of two ballot measures have made it official. They'll be asking for recounts on the marijuana and education initiatives. Maine-based shoe manufacturer New Balance tries to quell the uproar over a Wall Street Journal interview some saw as pro-Trump and the subsequent defense of the remarks on a white supremacist website. And a federal judge rules that Bangor's ordinance regulating methadone clinics is discriminatory. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs. And Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at mainegardens.org.
I'm Barbara Caritti. The election that seemed to have no end just keeps on going here in Maine. Opponents of two ballot measures have made it official. They'll be asking for recounts. Opponents of Question 1, which allows for the taxation and regulation of recreational marijuana, and opponents of Question 2, which would raise taxes to provide more funding for local schools, have submitted the required number of petitions to begin the recount process. Mal Leary has more.
The winning margin separating the yes side from the no side in both Question 1 and Question 2 are small, less than 1%, and state law says that is close enough to formally request a recount. The law also requires the state to pay for the cost of the recount. Newell Auger, an attorney for the group that opposed passage of the marijuana referendum, says it's important Mainers to know for sure that the results of the election are accurate.
We had more than two-thirds of the communities in the state of Maine rejected this proposal. And but for my hometown of Portland, this measure would have lost by more than 1.5%.
And David Clough, Maine director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, says the tax increase in Question 2 will have a big impact on his organization's members who often file their small business income through the personal income tax.
There's a lot of opportunity for mistakes to be made, very inadvertent mistakes. We think that it's such a significant issue and the vote was so close that we'd like to know what the verified count is on the issue.
Both Auger and Clough said they had no problem getting well over the 100 petition signatures needed to trigger the recount process. Meanwhile, supporters of both Question 1 and Question 2 say they are confident their unofficial wins will be validated by the recount. Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says a statewide recount is time-consuming and expensive. He estimates counting nearly 770,000 ballots that were cast in each referendum will take 6 weeks and cost about $500,000. Dunlap says it's not just his office that gets involved in the process.
They'd have to be retrieved from the 503 towns and the unorganized territories that might have polling places. State police have to do that, so they're going to have to work out their logistics as well.
State law requires state troopers to pick up the ballots in their sealed boxes and transport them to Augusta, where they will have to be kept in a secure facility. Dunlap says, based on past experience, recounting every ballot by hand means only about 25,000 votes can be counted in a day. He says his staff oversees the public process, where occasionally errors are uncovered.
You have a number of towns or a town that doesn't have a tabulating machine, and they're doing everything by hand. It's late at night, and somebody transposes 17 to 71. And so the recount will reveal that, and it will change the outcome of the election.
Dunlap says in a legislative race, the margin can often be a few dozen votes. So transposing a number on a tally sheet can, and has, changed election results. He says it will take a lot of such mistakes to shift the thousands of votes in the two referendum recounts. Because of the upcoming holidays, it could be the new year before the two statewide recounts are completed. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And two races for the Maine House will also be the subject of recounts. Officials with the Secretary of State's office say recount requests were made for House District 78 and 121. In District 78, which includes Benton and Winslow, Democrat Catherine Netto beat Republican Benjamin Twitchell III by 148 votes. In District 121, which includes Alton, Corinth, Hudson, Milford, and the unorganized territory of Argyle Township, incumbent Democrat Robert Duchesne defeated Republican Gary Drinkwater by 22 votes. House district recounts usually take about a half a day. The recount in District 78 will occur on Thursday, and the District 121 recount is scheduled for Friday. Meanwhile, Governor Paul LePage's energy director is stepping down. As Steve Missel reports, what led to Patrick Woodcock's departure is not clear.
The LePage administration announced today that Patrick Woodcock will leave the position effective December 9th. Woodcock began overseeing the governor's energy office in early 2013. He joined the LePage administration after nearly 7 years working for former U.S. Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican. He was Snow's senior advisor on energy and environmental issues from 2005 until he joined LePage's team. Upon joining the LePage administration, Woodcock sought to implement the governor's goal of expanding natural gas capacity in the state and cutting prices for ratepayers. That role has often put him at odds with the state's environmental groups, as well as renewable energy advocates. Woodcock also played a part in helping the administration negotiate the 2013 Omnibus Energy Bill with lawmakers. The sweeping legislation sought to increase natural gas pipeline capacity, while also bolstering efficiency programs. Woodcock told Maine Public Radio News that it was time to move on. He expressed frustration with policy change in Augusta, citing lawmakers' reliance on lobbyists and special interest groups. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
And now to the public relations nightmare that's ensnared Maine-based athletic gear company New Balance. The day after Donald Trump emerged the victor in the presidential race, a company spokesperson gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal that some interpreted as pro-Trump. Backlash via social media against the remarks was swift. But what was already an image crisis for the company has been made worse as a white supremacist website rushes to its defense. Jennifer Mitchell has more.
That's the sound of a pair of New Balance shoes being flushed down a toilet. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter are awash with videos of the shoes being flushed, burned, and trashed after a company spokesperson told the Wall Street Journal that with President Trump, the country would, quote, move in the right direction, end quote. Soon after, a neo-Nazi website called the Daily Stormer took up the torch in support of New Balance. In a November 12th post, the website declared New Balance to be the, quote, official shoes of white people, end quote. New Balance did not respond to our request for an interview about the original comment or about the subsequent neo-Nazi endorsement. And that was exactly right, says Nancy Roberts, who teaches public relations at Hudson University.
Yes, because anything more they might say in a conversation or an interview could fuel this fire even further. And they really wanted to go away.
Roberts, who also consults in communications crisis management, says New Balance is in a tough position because the backlash involves interpretation and viral hearsay rather than concrete facts. For example, she says when Toyota had to recall faulty auto parts or food chain Chipotle had to respond following an outbreak of food poisoning, the actual issues that needed fixing were clear.
This really didn't involve their customers directly, and that makes it more challenging.
In an emailed statement, New Balance says the right direction comment was taken out of context and specifically referred to a question on trade policy and nothing else. That's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which New Balance has vocally opposed. So did Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her party challenger, Bernie Sanders. Just a few months ago, New Balance was seen as an underdog in a global market, the David that had won the right from Goliath to supply the U.S. military with its domestically made athletic footwear. So how did the tables turn so quickly? Jason Sullum, vice president of Broadreach Public Relations in Portland, says he's not sure, but driving the narrative is essential.
The key is just to be out in front of it as much as you can and to make sure that you're the ones telling your story and somebody else isn't.
Sullum says companies must constantly monitor social media sites and look for troubling flare-ups. A single blogger, he says, can create a firestorm. Nancy Roberts at Husson agrees.
We've got individuals who aren't willing to seek out their news in traditional sources, but instead use social media, and we're finding more and more it may or may not be reliable.
In the past few days, New Balance has made the following statement. New Balance does not tolerate bigotry or hate in any form. The statement goes on to say that the company employs thousands of employees of all races, genders, cultures, and sexual orientations, describing itself as a values-driven organization and culture that believes in humanity, integrity, community, and mutual respect for people around the world. But as if to illustrate what companies like New Balance are up against, the neo-Nazi website in question has rejected that statement, claiming instead that New Balance's tweet was hacked. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
Coming up, a judge rules that Bangor's ordinance governing methadone clinics is discriminatory, prompting the clinic to move ahead with its lawsuit against the city. The Penobscot County Metro Treatment Center is moving forward with its lawsuit against the city of Bangor after a federal judge ruled Tuesday that a city ordinance regulating methadone clinics is discriminatory. But the court did not grant the center's request for injunctive relief, and that means, pending a favorable court ruling, the clinic's client base will remain at no more than 300 patients. A.J. Higgins reports.
In its 7-2 vote over the summer, the Bangor City Council denied the methadone clinic's request to expand to 500 patients. Under the terms of a local ordinance, councilors demanded that the clinic respond to a series of questions. Among them, is there a demonstrated need for those services, and are the methadone treatment services provided where they're needed? During an interview in September, John Doyle, an attorney representing the clinic, said Bangor's review process violated the Americans with Disabilities Act and that Penobscot Metro was in full compliance with all state criteria related to expansion.
We pointed out in our original filing and in the hearings that we had met all the state requirements. The state allows us to go up to 500. The state allowed Discovery House to go up to 700. And the city's purporting to hold us to 300 based on a review process that's totally in conflict with the state's process. So we think it's discriminatory as it's applied, and we certainly think it's discriminatory under the case law we've cited under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
On Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge John Woodcock agreed, saying, quote, "The ordinance to single out methadone clinics and devise special rules to apply to them as opposed to all other types of clinics is facially discriminatory." Woodcock did not grant the clinic's request for injunctive relief, which would have allowed the facility to proceed with expansion plans immediately. Bangor Mayor Joe Baldacci said the city was pleased with that aspect of the court's ruling, as well as with other conclusions, including one in which the judge stated that there are slots available at other clinics for as many as 60 other patients who Penobscot Metro contended were not being served.
I think we showed that there were slots or available treatment slots at other facilities that hadn't been fully explored by this facility. And they had not, as the court found, they had not fully documented the need or the immediate need for the services.
Representing the clinic, John Doyle declined to go on tape for this story and instead offered a written statement saying that in the absence of receiving injunctive relief, the clinic will be forced to continue to turn away people in urgent need of critical care and ready to enter treatment. The case is expected to go to trial early next year. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Meanwhile, after 3 years of negotiations, the S.T. Warren Company has agreed to remove the Sacarapa Hydroelectric Project, the second dam on southern Maine's Presumpscot River in downtown Westbrook. The agreement, reached with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Maine Department of Marine Resources, the City of Westbrook, and two conservation groups, also calls for construction of fish passage at Sacarapa Falls. It will be at least 2020 before the barrier is removed, but Sean Mahoney of the Conservation Law Foundation says when it's gone, 5 miles of the most productive habitat on the river will be opened up.
And is going to, we believe, lead to the restoration of hundreds of thousands of river herring, alewives and blueback herring, and American shad, and may even bring back Atlantic salmon.
The Presumpscot River was once home to hundreds of thousands of migratory fish. The first dam on the river upstream of Casco Bay was removed in 2002 after flood damage. Terms of the agreement must still be ratified by the company's board of directors and by the Westbrook City Council. And in a year of rampant negativity, Mary Latham is crossing the country looking at the positive. Latham is a couple of weeks into her More Good road trip, where she's finding and documenting acts of random kindness all over the United States. Latham is a photographer, and she's documenting her stories online. The stories cheered her and her family up when her own mother was ill, and eventually she's hoping to turn them into a book for hospital waiting rooms. Latham arrived in Maine earlier this week, and Nora Flaherty asked her what she's heard so far in Maine.
I met with a man whose friend that he worked with, he became friends with working at Maine Medical, donated a kidney to him. So he told me all about that story. It was really beautiful. I also met with another woman who told me a nice story about, you know, she was just walking home one day from work, and she was passing a couple, two men that were together that were holding hands. And she just, you know, looked up at them and smiled like you would do, you know, and they really reacted and were like, see, you know, one of them was saying to his partner, see, you know, we just want to say thank you. You know, we're on our way right now to go tell his family that we're together. And this is the first time we walked down the street holding hands. And, you know, you smiled at us, and they like gave her a hug, and they were just like, you know, you really helped us get there. And it was just such a little thing, but it was so cool.
How and why did you begin this project?
So this project began back in 2012, the day of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. I was working at a law firm, and I was at my desk. I was reading the news as it was coming in. It was a Friday morning, and I was horrified. My coworker stopped by my desk, and he told me a story. That morning, just a few moments before, as I'm reading this news, he was online to get his coffee at Starbucks, and it was free, because a man had gone in earlier and was buying gift cards, since it was around Christmas when the shooting had happened. And he was getting gift cards for his employees, and he got an extra one for $100 and said, run it out on the people behind me. And so my friend was one of the lucky ones to get a coffee. And I called my mom, that I did every morning at work, and checked in with her and told her the story about the coffee, and quickly refocused over to the shooting, and was talking about that for a while before she politely interrupted me and said, you know, Mary, there's always going to be these terrible things that are happening that we can't explain, that are going to happen in the world, and tragic events. You have to stay focused on that man with the coffee that woke up that morning, and, you know, he made 20 people's day with their free coffee. And, you know, that will be what gets us through these dark times. And she was going through her second round of cancer. She'd had it 10 years prior, and it was a pretty bad prognosis. And so I thought I would try to really channel those words she had told me and start a project where I could collect nice stories like this, because I'm sure they were happening everywhere. You just don't really hear about them as much.
How many people are you expecting to talk to in the course of this whole adventure?
Ooh, I have no idea. It's kind of exciting. I thought I'd be in Connecticut for maybe 2 or 3 days. And then more people reached out with more couches, and I got some more good stories. And so I ended up being there for, I think it was 8 days. And then I got to Rhode Island, and some people reached out to me there. Originally, I was just going to stay with two different people, and then I was with four. So it's kind of just been very fluid, where I'm going where the stories are and kind of staying in, you know, 6 or 7 days in each place right now, which if I'm staying that long in Connecticut, maybe I'll have to spend a month in Hawaii. I don't know.
What's your ultimate goal with this project?
Well, right now, the goal is to just kind of expose all of the good that's going on, to really highlight positive stuff for a country that is pretty down, I would say, right now. And I think to kind of compile all of them and not just put them in hospital waiting rooms, but really put them in any place. They're needed everywhere. I think everyone could use a boost of hope and to just see all these amazing people out there and be inspired by them and really just have something nice to read, have something, you know, nice to the photos to look at and kind of feel like they went on the trip too and saw all the things I got to see and met the people.
All right, Mary Latham, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was photographer Mary Latham talking with Nora Flaherty. You can check out Mary Latham's stories of kindness with photos on Facebook by searching for Gratitude Project, spelled with two T's like attitude, with a GR in front. And one of the key authors of the Clean Air Act and a former aide to Maine Senator and Secretary of State Ed Muskie has died. Leon Billings died Tuesday in Nashville, Tennessee at age 78 after suffering a stroke. As the first staff director of the Senate Environment Subcommittee, Billings was a primary author of the 1970 Clean Air Act, one of the first and most influential environmental laws in U.S. history, and a foundation for the nation's current air pollution laws. Billings also played a key role in the 1972 Clean Water Act. He served as Muskie's environment advisor and later was his chief of staff in the Senate and when Muskie was Secretary of State. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Such a fruitful storm in terms of quenching the New England drought. Now the system is en route to Quebec City overnight. It will maintain showers along the international border. Over the mountains, clouds may break up a little bit, but look for gradual clearing from southwest to northeast throughout the balance of the state. Low to mid-40s for most, upper 30s in the western valleys. This unusually mild regimen will hold rock solid through Saturday. Tomorrow, expect considerable cloudiness over northern Maine as well as the mountains, with abundant sunshine for the remainder of the state. Breezy, upper 40s to upper 50s. 50s north to south. Friday, other than a few clouds north, we'll enjoy abundant sunshine near 50 in the St. John Valley to the low 60s interior southern sections of Maine. Saturday will be mostly sunny for western and southern Maine, while clouds fan out across the rest of the state. There is a possibility of late-day showers along the New Brunswick border, 50 statewide. A market pattern shift will click in Sunday. Showers widespread, snow showers over the mountains, windy and colder. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, November 16, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina. And to Mal Leary, Steve Missler, Jennifer Mitchell, A.J. Higgins, Nora Flaherty, and Ed Morin for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.